Welcome to American Variety Radio. I'm your host, Court Lewis. Well, you know, over the years, we've had a few shows dealing with paleontology, which is, as you probably know, basically the study of ancient life forms, mainly dinosaurs, through fossils. There was one show back quite a while ago on a mastodon found in Tennessee that was in conjunction with Native American weapons and tools and a campfire where they clearly had butchered this large animal and cooked it. So that was an interesting paleontological find, I guess, as well as anthropological. And then we had on, at one point, a professor who curates the world's largest collection of ancient fossilized dung. And so that was kind of humorous as it sounds, right? And we couldn't help ourselves. We laughed a few times, but we were trying to keep it serious. But I've never done a show on dinosaurs, and I'll admit I don't know much about the subject. But my guest does, and she's joining us today from Malaysia, of all places, to tell us about what is possibly the most amazing find of dinosaur fossils in the history of paleontology in a remote area of China. Jingmei O'Connor is an American who's a professor at the Institute of Vertebrate Paleontology and Paleoanthropology, luckily it uses an acronym most of the time, of the Chinese Academy of Sciences, where she studies the origin and early evolution of birds. And she's young and a full professor at 32 just a little while back, and has already made a worldwide name for herself because she's full of energy, super smart, and is working right in the middle of this huge fossil trove. Welcome, Jingmei.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, thanks for being on from so far away. I guess we're at least three satellites away, so hopefully our sound quality will be good during this show. And thanks for joining us at around midnight your time. I hope you're a night owl.
No worries. I just love sharing my love for dinosaurs with anyone willing to listen.
Well, that's great. So first, tell us about this big new dinosaur region. Like, where is it in China, and how big is it, and when and how was it discovered?
Well, so China is a huge country, and there are tons of regions that are producing different dinosaurs from the Triassic, the Jurassic, the Cretaceous, all over, and a lot of important discoveries. But I particularly work on early Cretaceous fossils from the province of Liaoning. It's a region that produces the world-famous Jehol biota. This biota has basically answered a lot of questions about how did birds evolve from dinosaurs, which is my specialty.
So what's unusual about the dinosaur fossils being found there?
There's a lot of things that are interesting about it. But basically, it was this region that had been studied for the fossil fish that it was producing for decades and decades. And then in the early 90s, there started to be fossil birds that were discovered. And then in the 90s, they found the first feathered dinosaurs. This basically cinched the question of whether or not birds were dinosaurs, which up until then had been a debate. And there's still a few sticklers out there who refuse to accept. But so this area, once these, you know, incredible feathered dinosaurs started being discovered by scientists, then all these local farmers who, you know, subsist on very little from day to day, don't make a lot of money every year, started getting in on these discoveries. You know, how many paleontologists are there in the world? Not that many. But how many farmers are there in China? A lot. So basically what you have in China is the biggest collection of dinosaurs anywhere in the world. And these dinosaurs are collected primarily by farmers and then sold into museum collections all over China. So, for example, if you go to this one museum where I often like to work, that is, you know, the Guinness Book of World Records, biggest dinosaur museum in the world, and they have like 224 specimens of this one very important feathered dinosaur named Anchiornis. But because these discoveries are purchased, you know, all the fragmentary specimens don't work their way into the collections. If you go into this collection, it's 224 nearly complete, fully articulated specimens of this dinosaur, and maybe 10% of them preserve soft tissues, preserve feathers. And so I guess it's the preservation of feathers that really makes this particular region so important for paleontology.
Yeah, and even in addition to the feathers, I gather that, I mean, these are in such a state of preservation, a lot of them, that the colors are visible, and the hair and skin and organs, I mean, they're, you know, they're practically like roadkill from yesterday.
Exactly. If you look at one of these specimens, it's just like the entire bird's there, organic halo of its body. You can see all its feathers. Now, the actual color doesn't preserve, but if you sample some of the feathers and look at it under a scanning electron microscope, then you can see the organelles that are responsible for making color. And based on their morphology, you can then infer what color it might have been, because we, you know, look at these organelles in living birds, and then we see that certain shapes and sizes correlate with certain colors, and then we can try to make inferences. Except, you know, when this discovery first came to light, like, we got really excited about the idea that you could know what color a fossil dinosaur or a fossil bird was, right? But then we started doing studies on individual specimens, and they kept coming back like, oh, this one's black. Oh, this one's also black. And so then we started realizing that, well, melanosome-based coloration is just one form of coloration. It's just one aspect of coloration. There's actually a lot of other ways that colors are formed in feathers. You know, we still have research to do, but that's what science is. We start to understand something, but everything that we think we know right now is wrong. And that's something that people should know about science. All we're doing is making hypotheses based on the currently available information. And then when new information comes to light, we have to adjust our hypotheses. So for example, in feathers, some colors are actually made by they're called structural colors. And they're actually made by like pockets of air that are inside the nanostructure of the feather. So that type of coloration is something that we're never actually going to see preserved. But it's still a start, and it's still really exciting. And yeah, we recently published on a bird that preserves fossil lungs. So that was really exciting. And actually what I found was that there's actually other fossil lungs that have been described previously. There's a mammal that was even older, and also amphibians from Cenozoic, so more recent, that also preserve lungs. Those specimens actually don't tell us anything of the animal had lungs, which is like, duh, must have had lungs. But our specimen actually preserved the microstructure of the lung. And birds, you know, flight is the most physically demanding form of locomotion, and it requires a high amount of oxygen. So what we saw in the microstructure of this lung tissue was that the adapt living birds have, in order to meet this high oxygen demand powered flight, were present even in these early birds that are 125 million years old.
Yeah, I gather in some cases they're so well preserved that it's possible even to find out what the animal last ate, because the last animal it ate is also fossilized in its stomach. I mean, that's just wild, right? But out of all these dinosaurs that have been found in this region, there must be some new species, right? I mean, just in general, without itemizing what they are because we won't know their names, but has there been a real treasure trove of new species found as well?
Every year we get new species coming out. And actually, not only new species, we also get new groups of dinosaurs. And if you'll allow me to at least mention one, because they're my favorite group at the moment. It's a group named the Scansoriopterygidae, which is a mouthful. Basically, there's about five specimens known, and that's it. The first few were not very well preserved. So we knew that they were bird-like in some ways. So we thought maybe they're closely related to birds. As more complete specimens were discovered, what we found is that the reason it resembles a bird in some ways is because this dinosaur is also flying, but it's flying in a way completely out of birds. Birds fly using wings formed out of feathers, right? This group of dinosaurs flew using wings made out of flaps of skin, more like a flying squirrel or a bat or a pterosaur. So this discovery is so cool because it tells us that flight evolved in dinosaurs at least three times, which is really cool.
You're listening to American Variety Radio. I'm your host, Court Lewis, and we're talking with an American paleontologist who's a professor at a university in China. Her name is Jingmei O'Connor, and she's telling us about a remote area in China where an enormous dinosaur fossil find has been made. And Jingmei, you're a specialist in bird precursors and the evolution of birds, so I think you've kind of told us already some of the things that have been most exciting for you to find in what's going on there, but is there one particular eureka moment where you really just blew your mind on something you found or saw?
I think one of the coolest things that I've worked on was this discovery of preserved ovarian follicles inside a number of birds that are about 125 to 120 million years old. Thinking about ovarian follicles preserving is just so bizarre. I mean, it's basically the egg yolk, but in the ovary before it's gone into the oviduct and become shelled and all that. Living birds only have one ovary. And they're the only amniotes, the only, you know, vertebrate animals that have one ovary. And this discovery told us that this trait actually can be traced back to the earliest birds. And that was kind of cool because if you read an ornithology textbook, they would just guess at why birds only have one ovary. And their guess was that it was related to flight in order to reduce weight during flight, right? So instead of having two eggs inside you, if you're, you know, you only have one. So if a predator pops out at you, you're lighter, you can fly away more easily. And what the fossils then showed us was that this hypothesis that was basically based on nothing was actually correct. Because we actually have some exceptional dinosaurs from Mongolia that preserved two eggs inside them. So we know that they still had two functional oviducts in dinosaurs closely related to birds. And then these incredible discoveries of birds from Jehol, with indicating there was a single ovary, included some of the very primitive birds, some birds with a long bony tail, like their dinosaurian relatives. So this showed us that the loss of the ovary happened at the dinosaur avian transition. So that was very cool. And this, I mean, there's just so many things that we've worked on, you know, like we can see the actual color patterns on the wings, like whether they had spots and things like this. We can trace the, you know, evolution of different aspects of like the skin of the wing. And, you know, I mentioned the discovery of this dinosaur Ichi, which was only discovered 3 years ago and just completely changed everything we thought about the evolution of flight and dinosaurs. And I mean, things like that are continuing to be discovered. So whenever some particular controversy pops up, you know, I always warn people against taking sides, because in a week or a month or a year, we might find another discovery that will just, again, change everything that we think. And so it's a really, really exciting field to be working in.
It's moving so fast. I mean, so since so many of the fossils are so well preserved, is it possible to do DNA analysis? And I guess you know where I'm going with that. You know, can we envision a Jurassic Park zoo out of yes. these things?
So this is everyone's favorite question to right, ask, right. You know, from first graders all the way up.
Oh, but, sorry about that.
No, it's a good question. And the answer is, we're never going to have Jurassic Park. Because, you know, for example, we have complete woolly mammoths that aren't even fossilized, right? They're just frozen. Mm-hmm. So now they've been unfrozen. But so you have the entire animal there and not petrified. And there are scientists who have been trying to clone these things and bring them back to life, and they can't do it. So if we can't clone an animal in which we have the entire carcass of, then what hopes do we have of cloning an animal from fragments of DNA? But the answer to your question is, we will be able to get fragments of DNA. We're already starting to be able to identify proteins. And I think that very soon, like greater little fragments of DNA sequences will probably be published. And another really cool thing that I'm working on, it's not from China, it's not from Liaoning, but it's one of the coolest new discoveries out there, is these animals trapped in 100 million year old amber from Burma. And so I've studied like practically an entire bird that is 100 million years old trapped in amber. I mean, it's incredible looking at these things, because you can see all the skin on their foot, and they're preserved in 3D, whereas all these fossils that I work on from Liaoning are two-dimensional. They've been compressed. So you do lose a lot of information that way. But I mean, if you have this animal basically mummified in amber, then, you know, the chance of getting DNA fragments from something like that are very high.
Yeah, okay, I understand. Well, this region in China that we've been talking about, is it a bigger deal for avian, you know, bird paleontology? I know you talked about the transition that you see sometimes between walking dinosaurs and flying dinosaurs. So is it a bigger area for bird paleontology than other areas? I mean, are they finding the classic big reptiles like Tyrannosaurus rex and Brontosaurus there, or is it mainly your kind of animals?
Well, there are some bigger dinosaurs that have been found. For example, there's a famous relative of T-Rex called Eutyrannus that is also from this region. It's smaller than T-Rex, but it's also feathered. Well, it has proto-feathers, but still it made quite a splash in the media because it showed for the first time that the Tyrannosaur lineage also possessed feathers. I don't think that T-Rex would have been covered in feathers, but I do think that maybe baby T-Rex was covered in feathers because it would have been really small. And as it grew up, it might have shed these feathers, molted. So we do have some larger stuff there as well, but mostly we have smaller animals because it's ancient lake deposits. So we're getting a lot of these small animals who have like fallen into the lake. Some of the larger dinosaurs come from volcanic deposits that are like interbedded within these lake deposits. But the Liaoning, the Zhehol biota, it's the number one place in the world to study avian paleontology, Mesozoic avian paleontology, and it's the best place in the world in order to understand the dinosaur avian transition. And the fossils that come from there account for more than half of the entire diversity of Mesozoic birds that we know of. And while, you know, we get maybe 4 or 5 new species every year, at least, you know, around the world, maybe there's 1 new species a year named, if even that. So it's definitely what drew me to working in China. I mean, I did my PhD on studying early bird evolution. So, you know, I just figured might as well go to the Mecca, you know?
Yeah, yeah, you're definitely in the sweet spot. So you talked about the farmers for whom it's basically a gold rush there. You know, they probably go at it with, you know, with bulldozers, I mean, instead of toothbrushes. So what are the downsides to the way that's being done? I mean, what does that do to the dinosaur record, the fossil record?
So everything is a double-edged sword, right? And so there's good and bad to everything. So the good side is that we have thousands of specimens. And with 200 specimens of a single taxon, there's so much more that you can learn about that species than if you only have 1 or 2 specimens. So you can tell if the males or females were different. You can understand how the animal changed from when it was a baby to an adult. You can understand what it was eating, et cetera, et cetera. The downside is that a lot of the times we don't know exactly where the specimen came from stratigraphically. So, you know, a foot of rock can equal hundreds of thousands of years. So if you don't know exactly if it came from this lower level or from this upper level, or if it came from Western Liaoning or Eastern Liaoning, you know, without that information, it's difficult for us to do studies understanding how these bird faunas would have changed throughout time. So we kind of, you know, talk about them as big chunks, you know, like, these are all from this, you know, 120 to 125 million year period. And these other ones are from this 128 to 125 million year period. And we can't tell whether or not one species might have lived more in the southern area and another species in a different area. So these kind of fine-tuned studies at the moment, we haven't been able to do. But, you know, there is hope in the future to do geochemical sampling of all the different rocks and then of all the different specimens and try to be able to match up the geochemistry to be able to figure out exactly where the fossils came from. I mean, the point is there's so many fossils that there are, you know, it could keep 100 paleontologists busy for 200 years. Like there's tons and tons of work to do there still.
Yes, I was going to ask you if you feel kind of like you're in a race with the farmers who are digging up fossils to sell and wrecking the paleontological record in the process, but it sounds like it's so big that it kind of doesn't matter. You can do what you need to do and they can do what they do, and it doesn't really impact you that badly, it sounds like.
Yeah, and also the type of fossil collecting there is quarrying. Mm. So it's, you know, it's slab work. You break off a chunk of rock and you turn it on its side and you try to break off a slab. So it's extremely tedious. It takes a really long time. And you can, you know, work there for 10 hours a day for a month and find maybe one bird. The truth of the matter is, it's not something I really want to do myself. So I'm actually really happy that there are these huge collections of fossils that have already been collected by farmers and brought into museums that I can just go into a nice air-conditioned museum and just sit there and measure fossils and study them.
Well, here I was thinking of you as a female Indiana Jones, but maybe it's more like New York City Jones. I don't know. Anyway,
well,
you want to be comfortable.
Don't get me wrong, like being out in the field is the best part of paleontology, but you know, I really like roaming through badlands and, you know, going where nobody's been before and, you know, finding some piece of bone on the ground that nobody's seen before. I mean, it's an incredible feeling, but sitting in, you know, one spot for weeks and just splitting slabs is a very different matter. I don't think you can imagine Indiana Jones doing that. So
yeah, I was being facetious, of course. So when you're dealing with the giant, you know, I picture pickup loads of bones that are being brought in by these guys and they're all jumbled up like, you know, like a giant jigsaw puzzle that's been thrown together and, you know, put in a blender or something. And is it a problem to assemble intact original animals from that patchwork of stuff, or does it actually not that bad and it comes in more intact than that?
our specimens, like you said yourself earlier, they look like roadkill. So it's just, you know, you actually have a slab, like imagine like a hardcover book, you know, about that much thickness, you know, that's where it's, how it's broken off. And it just has a complete animal, fully articulated, which means all the bones are in place. So you can just, you know, head bones connected to the neck bones connected, like everything's connected. So there really isn't a lot of puzzle work necessary.
Okay, well, that's good. So when you are out in the field, you know, what are living conditions like? I mean, it's not like there's a Hilton nearby. Are you living in a tent or what's that like, just briefly?
Well, I actually prefer when there is no hotel nearby and we're living in a tent. But unfortunately, Chinese don't seem to really like camping. So if there is a hotel nearby, even if it's a terrible one, they will prefer to stay there. So I've stayed in some pretty gross hotels.
Okay.
But even worse, like sometimes they'll just stay in the farmer's house located nearby. And it's pretty, you know, it's pretty rough conditions. Like, I guess I'm a bit spoiled since I don't go out in the field in China very often. I much prefer, you know, camping out in the wilderness, finding some solitary place to use the bathroom. Like, I don't want to be using some old farmer's outhouse. But I mean, of course, I will if I have to.
You know, I did read that there are a lot of fossil museums, more than you would think, you know, springing up in this fairly remote area. But that a lot of them are more like what I would think of as roadside tourist attractions and not places for serious scientific study where they have, you know, a scientific staff and so on. So do you interact with those types of museums? And if so, what's the interaction like? Is it very easy and smooth or, you know, or is there some degree of tension there? Or what's that like, just briefly?
So you're correct. There are a ton of museums in China. And actually, it's kind of cool because some of them, there's like quite a number of millionaires who have taken it upon themselves to build museums because of their own love for paleontology. I've only been to one of them, which is the one I mentioned. That's the Guinness Book of World Records biggest dinosaur museum in the world. And that's the only museum that I work with besides my own institute. There's a lot of other museums that they're not like these weird gimmicky roadside museums. They're actually beautiful, huge structures filled with amazing fossils. But yeah, there's no actual scientific staff there to facilitate access to them. They really are more just a tourist attraction. They're there to make money or to garner somebody's reputation, like the mayor of some city or whatever. So it's unfortunate that there's so much amazing material that's inaccessible. You know, the Tianyu Museum has this huge and incredible collection, and it's located in Shandong province, so it's actually not even in Liaoning. There are also very cool dinosaurs being discovered in Shandong, but anyways, I digress. So being able to work with these rural museums is one of the reasons that I took it upon myself to improve my Chinese and to study Chinese. Also because I've been living there for 9 years and it would just kind of be insane not to speak a little bit. Most foreigners don't speak anything more than like this, that, and thank you, which is all you need to order food. But so, I mean, there's all these oddities about trying to interact with these museums, and it can be a little bit of a pain. But honestly, the collection in this museum is worth jumping through hoops. You know, it's just, it's so incredible.
Yeah, that was a question I should have asked you earlier, and your first name is Jing Mei, and so I was going to ask you if you speak Chinese. I guess you just pretty much answered that. You had to learn it pretty much when you got there, so doing your work and learning Chinese on the run, too, must have been a challenge.
Yeah, I'm half Chinese and half Irish-American, as my name implies. Kind of indicates.
Yeah, right.
But unfortunately, as a kid, my mom, well, she had four kids, so I'm not going to blame her for not teaching us Chinese. But I did study Chinese for 1 year in college, and I guess that gave me a basic grasp of how the language works. I wouldn't say that I really remember much vocab from it. But yeah, after being there for 9 years, you slowly pick stuff up. And I have, you know, tried to learn different anatomical terms. And I mean, I'm basically at the point where if I have a translator, because I can't understand very well, it's this weird problem I have. If the question is translated to me, then I can answer it in Chinese. Mm-hmm. And and I think it's really important to, you know, not be a foreigner, but to really try to integrate.
Well, I'd say, you know, paleontology, And we just have a couple minutes left here, but paleontology has always been about, I guess, collecting and identifying and characterizing and cataloging fossils. In other words, the fieldwork part of building museum collections and then the studying part of it in those collections. So it's like we said before, it's not exactly Indiana Jones and not as high tech as, say, chemistry or biology are. Is that changing? Is it becoming more technology-based? Just kind of briefly.
Yeah, actually, there's like kind of a renaissance going on in paleontology right now, and it's from a number of aspects. It's one because of incredible new discoveries, primarily from China, but also from other places like Burma I mentioned. And the other thing is because we're changing how we perceive paleontology. So we're starting to go beyond just the skeleton and starting to study soft tissues that we kind of ignored before. The other aspect is the application of technology and things like chemistry to the study of paleontology. People are taking fossils and they're, you know, exposing them to synchrotron radiation in order to see inside the skeleton. And there's this one brilliant young scientist at Yale right now who's, understanding the chemistry of how things fossilize. And I mean, it's just incredible what she's doing. Like she just recently did a study on, the color of dinosaur eggshells, which is really cool. And there's a lot of really interesting things that are going on in paleontology right now. So it's really moving away from that old guys with white beards digging in the dirt, this kind of perception that people have about paleontology. I think in 20 years, people will see it in a very different light.
Well, I think you're helping that happen. So again, boy, we're really at the end here, and I don't know if it's fair to even ask you this question to answer in 30 seconds or less or whatever, but what have we learned from these great finds there in China that you're doing in particular about the evolution from big, ferocious, meat-eating, winged and feathered dinosaurs to today's pretty little birds? I mean, in a nutshell, what have we learned that's new in the last few years about that transition?
Well, birds are these really special animals. They're unlike any other animal alive. And what we are basically learning is that all these things that we think of as bird characteristics actually have their origin deeper within the dinosauria. So a lot of these things, like, for example, flight or feathers or, even a beak, a lot of features evolved in dinosaurs. And so that's really cool. And the other thing that we're learning is that birds are not the only flying dinosaurs. In fact, in the late Jurassic, there were a lot of dinosaur lineages that were experimenting with different types of volant behaviors, different ways of flying. So there was Ichi with its bat-like wing. There was Microraptor with wings on its forelimbs and its hind limbs. And then there was also the lineage that was going towards birds. So it was a really exciting time during evolution. We don't know exactly why so many animals were exploring flight, especially because the pterosaurs were already ruling the skies. So it wasn't like that niche was open. So just as we're getting so many answers, there's still so many remaining questions. It's really cool.
So quickly, what's a good website for people to go to learn more about Liaoning, Cenosaur? There's a lot of them, so can you pick one?
Well, actually, yeah, I was going to say, I use the internet for my research and that's about it. So I just encourage people to get out there on Google and pose their questions, and I'm sure they'll find lots of good sources out there.
Okay, I think they can search China Avian Paleontology, and I'm not going to bother spelling all that, but I think they can find things. They can find what they need there. Jingmei O'Connor, thank you so much for being on with us on American Variety. It's been fascinating.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me.
I appreciate, especially from you being on from halfway around the world. And thanks to all of you for listening. I hope you'll tune in again next week, same time, same place for more American Variety Radio.